Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So I'll be continuing the discourses on how to meditate. The skillful means which I've developed over the years I've been meditating, just showing you exactly what's happening and how it works, because it's more important that you all develop these incredibly peaceful, powerful states of mind, and with that stillness you can see things as they truly are, and you can find out the Dhamma for yourselves. Instead of telling you what to believe or what the truth is, it's more important you find out for yourself. And a way to find out is the Eightfold Path culminating in Sama Samadhi, and to be able to develop that stillness of the mind is important. And as you all know, that the whole monastery is set up just in Dhammasara, eventually, if not now, set up for people to develop Samadhi so they can see the Dhamma. So, as you all know, it's sometimes difficult to develop those peaceful states of mind. And so that's why I spend all these talks in the first part of any retreat just on how it works. And the particular emphasis today will be on the use of perceptions. I think it's in one sutta, but it's certainly it's mentioned in the Potapada Sutta somewhere, that just as one perception arises, another one vanishes. And this is actually the way we use our meditation objects, to go deeper and deeper and deeper into stillness. We don't just use the single perception all the way through, which is weird for people who just watch the breath and think they've got to watch the breath all the way. The simile which I use, which I gave recently to one of the people on the interview, is a simile which, you know, basically comes from the Samanyapala Sutra, where the King Ajatasattu says he came from the palace to the Weluwan of the bamboo grove by chariot, as far as chariots can go. And then he got out of the chariot and then walked in his shoes as far as he could walk with his shoes. And then when he got to the sala, the hall, he had to take his shoes off and enter the hall where the Buddha was sitting. Because you can't take shoes into the hall, and you can't take the chariot into the monastery, you have to leave it outside. Each vehicle does its purpose, and once the purpose is complete, you have to leave that vehicle behind to go to something more refined. From a chariot, you go to walking in shoes, and from shoes, you take them off, and there you get into the hall. In exactly the same way that in this meditation practice, we develop deeper and more profound perceptions. And part of the practice of meditation, part of what will bring you success, is developing the sensitivity to those very refined and subtle perceptions. Without developing that subtlety of perception, you'll find the path into deep meditation is closed to you. So, you know, we start with some very rough perceptions, the perception of this physical lump called our body, which is a rough perception. And in order just to let that one go, we usually turn onto something like the breathing. Of course, many of you know the way that I teach. If you go onto the breath too soon, it means that the only way you can keep the breath is by force, by controlling. And to keep that perception by force is so unpleasant, you can't maintain it very long. You wander off. Which is why that we have those beginning stages of present moment awareness and silence. But I was just teaching just in Sydney on the weekend the importance of actually understanding what you mean by the present moment now. Which is why I introduced to them, and I introduced to you now, it's a little skillful means which I've introduced before, is of the three levels at each stage of meditation. The first level is recognition, it's present moment awareness. You actually recognize what I mean by that. And in the teaching of meditation, it's really quite amazing. Especially when you teach lay people, you say present moment awareness, and they haven't got a clue what you mean. And the reason is, it's very rare that they stay in the present moment. So rare they're not familiar with it, they don't know what you're talking about. It's unexplored territory for people. So you have to have little exercises to show them what present moment awareness actually is. They can recognize it. And that becomes the first level of any stage. You recognize what you're doing, what we're talking about. You have to develop the perception of present moment. You recognize it, you know it. This is what's called present moment. And the reason why it is difficult for many people, because some of these like are part of the mental territory, which again is unexplored by so many people. They've explored the world, they know about sight, sound, smells, tastes and touches, but the mental world, again, they may know sort of fear, they may know depression, all those sorts of stuff. But the more refined objects in the mental world, such as the present moment awareness, is sometimes hard for people to get their head around. But eventually we recognize what we're talking about by present moment. So when I say just present moment awareness, you know exactly what's meant. And from that recognition, once you know what's meant, it means you can use that as an object in your meditation at the very beginning. You're not watching your breath, you're not watching the sounds, you're not watching your body. You're watching that particular perception, that one aspect of reality called now. And with training, with persistence, you can do that with ease. It's just a training in perception to pick up a particular field which you can perceive, which many people are just not skilled in looking at. And I gave the old simile to the person in the interview that when I was growing up, I could only see the beauty in music when it was rock music, loud and quite coarse, which is why I like things like The Doors and Jimi Hendrix. And only later on at university did I start getting more refined, and I could perceive the beauty in classical music. When I was 16 or 15 or whatever, the classical music was just so boring. How could anyone sort of listen to such rubbish? My perceptions were not refined enough. And from classical music, of course, then you move to the more delightful music of all, the music of silence in meditation. And sometimes people say, meditate, what are you doing? Nothing to do, that's boring. You can't see any peace or happiness. You can't see any pleasure there at all, because their perceptions are far too coarse. So even with listening to sounds, I developed my perceptions to be able to be so refined and subtle that you could understand the pleasure, the beauty of silence. You knew what silence was. So this is the same with the present moment awareness. You develop the perception of your present moment. That's your meditation object. That's what you're perceiving. That's what fills your mind. Everything else is secondary. Whether it's the sound or the feeling happening now, that's secondary to the fact of its now-ness, its presence. And once you get your head around that, you develop that perception. Of course, the next three levels are familiarity. With repeated recognition, time after time after time, you get so familiar with this meditation object that you can proceed to the next level, which is ease. You're at ease with the present moment. In other words, you know it so well, you relax in its presence. Because without that state of ease, there will always be a little bit of interference called controlling. Because, you know, you can't relax when it's a place you're not really at ease with. And every stage of meditation, it seems you have to go through those three levels to recognize exactly what that state is, to repeat it again and again and again till you're familiar with it, until you can relax totally into it. And of course, the simile I usually give is for those of you who first come to this monastery, or first go to Jhana Grove. When you first come to a place like this, you know, you don't know where it is, you don't know where everything is, you don't know where the toilets are, you don't know where your hut is, you don't know where anything is. I remember just going to Wat Ban Thap the first time. This is Ajahn Mahabua's monastery, and he has a reputation of being a very fierce monk. And the monks warn me, don't sort of go to his hut, because he'll sort of blast you, he'll shout at you. And that, they were doing that as they were taking me to my hut. And it was one of these forest monasteries. You turn left here, you turn right there, you go down to the second right and then to the second left. It was such a complicated route to get to where I was living. Maybe they did that on purpose to confuse me. And so I made a really great effort to remember all the turns in case, you know, I sort of turned the wrong way and went to Ajahn Mahabua's hut. But of course, the first day I was lucky, I managed to remember. But after two or three days, you knew all the places, you knew the whole monastery, and it was easy. You know, there's no way you could sort of go to where his hut was because you recognized everyone. You'd gone from recognition to familiarity. Then I could relax and just walk without worrying. So you have all these similes, these three levels. So many times, when you know your surroundings, you can relax into it. And when you relax into it, you're not controlling, you're not interfering with the process, or rather with the meditation object. So it's only when you get to that last level through recognition, familiarity, and then finally to ease, that you can relax, say, with the present moment. Only then does it stay. And you've completed that perception. You're perceiving the present moment, you know exactly what it is, and you relax with it, and it stays. The only reason why it does not stay, while the mind wanders off, while the meditation object fades. So there's two reasons. One is that you're just interfere with it, and so it just, you go backwards. Of course, the other way is you're so at ease with it, it settles down and then disappears as you go into the deeper stage. As one perception vanishes, another one arises, as the Buddha said. And that's what happens, you know, when the present moment disappears and the silence comes. And again, to recognize what we mean by that inner silence, to be familiar with it, so you can be at ease with it, so you do not disturb the silence. It's a very difficult thing to do, to be still and stay still, without sort of holding the mind with force, with the ease and relaxation. It just stays there, because you're so used to the silent mind. It's such a good friend, you relax in their company. Which is why that other way of dealing with these mental objects is making friends with them, as I've taught you before. Make friends with your body, make friends with the present moment, make friends with the silence, make friends with your breath. Because a friend is someone you relax with, you know them so well. You know all the idiosyncrasies, like the person you sit next to in the line. Yeah, you may not like them, but you know them so well that maybe when you first met them, you know, you were a bit tense around them, but now you know them so well, you know their sort of their ways of doing things, you relax. They become your friend. So, you know, you don't have to tense up or interfere, which means that, you know, you can sit with them at ease. Just like you can sit with the silence, it becomes your perception. And then when you go on to the next stage of the breath, again, many of you work with the breath, but even actually to perceive, what do you mean by the meditation object of the breath? And of course there's a huge amount of confusion about that. The object of the breath is not the feeling at the tip of your nose, or the belly or anywhere else. That's a physical feeling of, you know, the body. You're feeling the nose, you're feeling the belly, you're not feeling the breath. And that of course is a huge mistake which people make. I was fortunate to start off at the beginning with a really good teacher who told us just to watch the breath. And of course at first, what do you mean by the breath? That's why you do these little exercises. Breathe in and out three times. How do you know you breathe in? How do you know you breathe out? That is the experience of the breath. That is the perception I want you to watch. That perception which told you the breath was going in. The perception which told you the breath had finished going in. The perception of the pause between the breaths. It's a particular feeling, a particular perception. It's a particular mental object. What the heck do you mean by that? Well, the breath is finished going out. hasn't gone in yet. What is that? What is the experience like? Be mindful of that. Be aware of it. And after a while of much awareness, you understand what you mean by it. You become aware, you recognize the space between the breaths as a mental object, as something you can recognize, become familiar with, and become at ease with. So a lot of times you know that when you're watching the breath, that's where the mind wanders, in the space between the breaths. Why? Because you don't know what to do there. You don't recognize it as an object, you have got nothing to fix the mind on. But there's something there, you're not unconscious. It's the same with the breath. You just feel the experiences of the breath. Until you know the breath so well, you recognize the object of breath, not the nose, but the feeling of the breath going in or going out at every stage of the in-breath and the out-breath and in between. You can recognize that so well, you become so familiar with it, it is your friend. Which means you don't control it anymore. You don't tell it what to do. You relax in its presence, you're at ease with it. And that's when you have the perception of the breath. And of course, this is where it really gets interesting. This is why I just run through these early stages which you've heard before many, many times. When one perception ends, another one arises. And you develop the perception of when the breath starts to vanish. Many of you sort of have got to that stage, which is why I'm focusing on it now. The breath starts to vanish. Some people think, oh, I'm losing awareness of the breath, that's bad. And you stop the whole process. And the reason is because once the breath disappears, you don't know what to watch next. So when these things start to happen, when the breath starts to vanish, don't interfere with the process. Your job is to observe, not to control. What you can do is this automatic investigation. The breath has disappeared. I'm still alive, I'm still conscious. What am I conscious of? Get familiar. Sorry, recognize first that particular perception which occurs when the breath starts to vanish. You'll find that what that first is what we call the mental breath. This distinction which I made, that the breath which you're used to is the physical breath. By which I mean it's how you perceive the breath through the sense door of physical touch. And when it vanishes, it's a sign that the physical touch is being turned off. That particular sense door is shutting down. And the one which is left is the mind, the sixth sense. And what you experience, if you know, you follow this and develop the sensitivity of your mind, once that breath disappears, what you'll be aware of is the way the mind experiences the breath. It's a mental breath. It's seeing the breath, or rather experiencing the breath, through the sixth sense door. At first it's weird. And the reason it's weird, as I said from the beginning, is because mental objects have terra incognita, which means like unexplored territory for most people. In our life, we're so much caught up out there doing things in the world of the five senses. So that sixth sense is you just haven't learnt about it. You haven't had experience with it. So your perceptions of that world are very coarse. We have to learn about that world. So we recognize, just not by interfering, but just noticing, repeated noticing of what happens when the breath disappears. That's how I found out. I found out, you know, this experience when the breath vanishes. What the hell is that? Have I lost the breath? And of course, first time I made a mistake, which many of you do. You just go back to the breath and force the mind to breathe again, think you made some big mistake. But your meditation wasn't progressing. And when the breath disappeared, you realized it was peaceful, but what was it? So you had to develop that perception. When the breath goes, let it be, let it disappear. And after much experience, you can recognize that state. The good old friend, been there many times, I recognize you now, I know you very well. The perception of when the breath the physical breath vanishes. And it is very much like just going out from the lit room into the darkness, similarly. You first go out, you can't see anything. Give it a minute or two, you can start to recognize shapes. You can see. Same with just when these perceptions vanish, another one appears. They don't appear instantaneously after the first one vanishes. Not at these deep stages of meditation. You've got to wait for a while. Be patient. And as you wait for a while, the new one becomes quite clear. It's the recognition, the familiarity and the ease starts to happen. You become familiar with that state. You know it so well, and that's why it remains. And it remains and becomes clearer and clearer and clearer. You know that state well. And because you know it well, it remains. It's what I call the mental breath. The experience, not of the feeling the breath through the fifth sense, but through the sixth sense. Totally different animal. It's got some similarities. It's still the breath, but totally different. Smooth and easy. Sometimes I even call that the delightful breath, because there's some joy there as well. And one of the reasons I'm giving this talk is many people in their meditation can't find the joy. The beauty sukha is absent for them. And they find that a huge barrier in their meditation. And it is a barrier in the meditation. It's not just because I keep saying bliss out in your meditation and get frustrated I can't bliss out. It is because an important step on the path is not being taken. Because if you don't develop the piti sukha with, at this particular stage, the perception of bliss, it means that the meditation gets boring. It doesn't sort of bite. You don't love meditating. It becomes a chore. And after a while, many of you will give up. It's the getting this perception of bliss is so important, because then you really start to enjoy the meditation, and you really enjoy it, which means you like to do more. The mind is satisfied and will continue long and deeply. So it's developing that perception of bliss. Now, of course, the problem is that even happiness, our experience, our understanding of happiness is so limited. We only know the worldly happiness. But these types of happiness in meditation have a totally different character. Again, different than the joy from Jimi Hendrix to the joy of just listening to silence. Totally different animal. And when you realize that, you realize that this peace, which happens when the breath disappears, usually the mental breath, to experience a delightful breath, you have to develop the perception of the beautiful. Just leave it there for a while. It's peaceful. It's still. What is that like? How does it feel? And with repeated experience, the perception will arise that this is a delight, this is a pleasant abiding, this is a type of happiness, far more refined than you've been used to, but it really rocks. And after a while, once you recognize it's joyful, the joy increases. Just like when you go outside and you start to see things, the sights increase and your understanding of the forest in the darkness becomes more clear. It intensifies. And this is what happens. The joy, the peace, the piti sukha, a more refined happiness increases. And you become one of these people who can recognize that piti sukha. You become this like gourmet with these taste buds which are just so refined that you can understand, wow, this really is piti sukha. And far more refined. And of course, once you have that recognition, that particular piti sukha becomes very familiar to you. You recognize it, you understand it very good, and you can hang out there for long periods of time. And you know, that's my wish for each one of you. Just that much, and I'm a happy teacher. Of course, it's far more than that, but that's you on the path, you're going. You know, you're a meditator. You've got joy in the meditation at this particular stage. You can perceive that. You know what happens next? You get these beautiful lights in the mind. Sometimes these lights come earlier and they're just a bit of a hindrance, but when they come in the right order, that's when they're incredible. But you have to be able to perceive that joy and happiness first of all, because the nimittas, again, it's a particular type of perception. Because it's intense, that's why that many people can notice these things. What comes before them, between the breath and the nimitta, many of you get lost in that space. It's peaceful, it feels good, but nothing's happening. Where's the piti sukha? Where's the lights? They're not happening. You're looking for the wrong thing. Don't look for what's not there. Look for what is there. What is that state? What does that feel like? At the very least, you feel it's peaceful. Okay, I recognize peace. What is peace? Develop the perception of that mental object called peace until you're just incredibly expert on peace. And you'll find there's so many layers of peace. Peace is not just one thing. It's the same when, you know, going off to Sydney and people talking about mindfulness, mindfulness, mindfulness. Somebody asked me the old question. Yeah, I'm a busy mother, I don't have time to sit down. Is it, you know, mindful? I can be mindful while I'm vacuuming. I can be mindful while I'm changing my kids' nappies. That's still mindfulness, that's good enough. And of course the answer is just, look, madam, there's so many different levels of mindfulness. When you really develop the perception of mindfulness, you can see that this, you know, what I coined as mindfulness, power mindfulness, super power mindfulness, mega power mindfulness, and every shade in between. Millions of different levels of mindfulness. And your perception becomes refined enough to see that. It's not just mindfulness. Huge different qualities of mindfulness. It's a vast array of different levels and types of mindfulness. It's not just mindfulness. And because your perception has improved and increased, you know all of these things. That's your playground, that's where you hang out, that's your expertise in these different levels, because your perception has widened, grown, deepened, become more refined. So even if you just can't get the perception of joy, get a perception, what it feels like when the breath vanishes. What is that? And to know what it is, don't give it labels, don't give it names, just gather the data of experience until you recognize it. Because you know that sometimes that, you know, I travel around so much, you see people, and I know them, but I just don't know their name. I know you, but I haven't got a clue what your name is. You don't need to know a person's name. You just know them. And that's very similar with some of these states of meditation. I don't know their name, but I know what they are. And I recognize that afterwards, once I know what they are, I say, ah, now that's what that peace means. I go to those states, and then I recognize, ah, that's what they mean by that. And this is actually where you get your wisdom and insight, and also your ability to get deep into these meditations. You recognize these states, there's no longer any doubt, you understand what they are, because you've gone through the stages of recognition, familiarity and ease. You know what peace is. You've got something to focus on, something to watch. You don't tell me that, what do I do when the breath's gone, what do I watch? You watch just that. You develop that familiarity with that perception, your mind can focus on it with ease. Recognition, familiarity and ease. When it's ease, it stays. When it stays, it develops. If you don't stay on it, it just falls apart. You've got to sustain your attention on it through ease, not through willpower. Then it stays, you know it so well. And through that ease, then it develops. And that's where the beautiful nimittas come up. And when the nimittas come up, what the hell are these? You develop this perception. First, when these things come up, you feel, am I seeing something with my eyes? Now, so many people think they're imagining these things, or there's a bright light going on in there. are being shone in their face, because they don't recognize the difference between seeing a light, a headlight or a flashlight, and seeing these mental objects called nimittas. They're similar, but they're as different as chalk and cheese, as they say. At first, though, your perceptions are rough and coarse, so you can't do it. They'd feel the same, which means you're confused. But after repeated experience, you know that nimitta so well. You know what's a nimitta. You know what's a light being shone in your face. Fortunately, we don't go around shining flashlights in people's face in this monastery. So, you know, rule of thumb is, it's a nimitta. But it's great to actually to know the difference. It is a totally different perception. And you're getting used to these perceptions. And this is actually the training in meditation. The training in refining that particular aspect of the mind called perception. Until you can see some incredibly refined objects. Recognize them, not be confused by them, and rest in them. Where there's confusion, there'll never be any rest. Confusion leads to activity. Activity leads to agitation and disturbance, and the state of meditation disintegrating. You've lost it. So you perceive the nimitta. And it's, of course, it's not just one nimitta, there's hundreds of nimittas, all different types. So you become a connoisseur of nimittas, just like people in Western Australia and other parts of the world. I read these magazines and these newspapers, and people are really into food these days, and especially wines. Every Tom, Dick and Harry, you know, even sort of people who are just bricklayers, they're just into wine tasting. And just, you know, when I was growing up, yeah, wine was wine. I just couldn't tell the difference between one and the other. Maybe because I drank too much at the time, and just anything would go. But these days, you know, that people can actually taste the difference. And some people, these professional wine tasters, they've got what's called such a subtle palate. They can perceive differences, you know, which, you know, people like us would never be able to perceive. They train that perception. In the same way, I'm not sort of a connoisseur of wine, but I sure am a connoisseur of nimittas. If you want nimitta taster, I'm your man. So all the different types of it, you become so used to that area, you become quite, your perception becomes very refined. You know, that's really important. So some nimittas will take you into jhana, some never will. You understand their difference. Now, through getting into that place, often you have this recognition. You become familiar with them all. Just the same way that, you know, I recognize all of you now, I'm familiar with you. In the interviews, I get to know you, get to know sort of, you know, your idiosyncrasies, your weaknesses, your strengths. You get to know me, so you're not scared of me anymore. And so we're at ease with each other, hopefully. And you know sort of different aspects of me as I get to know different aspects of you. And it's the same with like the object, this mental object of a nimitta. That's what you're focusing on. It's not the breath. The breath has been left a long time ago. Just like you can't take the chariot, you know, into the hall at the Bamboo Grove Monastery. You can't take the breath into these states. It's too coarse. It's a physical object. You've got this mental object just watching the nimitta. Your perception is becoming more and more refined. And when you become familiar with it and at ease with it, it's the ease, this idea of being at resting, relaxing with something. So you don't have to hold it. Holding it means, you know, you're not at ease anymore. You're tensing up. You know, you're striving, coming from fear. Now, I'm saying a lot, fear is what is a cause of control. Fear is the enemy of letting things be. So you have to overcome that fear, and you overcome the fear through familiarity. You just understand it so well, you just relax, and you're at ease with it. And when you're at ease with things, that's where you can let them be. So sometimes, you know what it's like, you have to meditate and get into these states again and 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 again before you get to that state of ease. But once you know what you're doing, You listen to talks like this, you save a heck of a lot of time. You know exactly what's happening. You know what needs to happen. And you let it happen. And you get to the state of ease pretty quickly. And when you get to the state of ease, that's where things develop. That's where the progress comes. What you actually do is allowing so much recognition to happen, so familiarity happens, and then sort of the ease happens. So your actual job, as I keep on saying, is to do nothing, just but to be aware, to gather the data, not to interfere with anything, to make peace, be kind, be gentle, which allows the process to happen, allows the mind to teach you. You don't interfere in the same way that when I'm giving a talk, no one actually asks a question or interferes. In the same way when you know you're listening to a lecture at school, you never sort of interfere with your teacher, otherwise you get sent to the principal's office. You know, this is all just you being passive and just soaking in the information. That's what you do in meditation. You soak in these perceptions until you go through those stages of recognition, familiarity and ease. And you graduate when you get to the ease state. You stay with it. Nimitta stays. Doesn't go anywhere. Doesn't move. It's your friend. Same way you hang out with one of your friends. I was just talking to the lady who usually organises my trips when I'm in UK in London. And just asking her to apologise to these owners of restaurant in Victoria, because the last time I went there to eat 2 years ago, one of my old friends from university, I met him at Victoria bus station, and we walked from there to this restaurant. And you know what it's like, you go to a dhani, you're supposed to do some chanting, or at least talk to people. But this was a friend I hadn't seen for almost 40 years. Had so much catching up to do that I was heedless. I just was talking to him all the time. Talked about 4 hours. You know, I'm not a great talker, but it was just so natural. He was an old friend. We wanted to hang out together. So, you know, he actually came with me to Wimbledon Temple, and we were talking all on the underground all the way. He never planned to do that, just to catch up, say hello, and then go and do something else. But what really struck me was how easy it was to talk and stay with a friend for hours and hours and hours. And that's what it's like with a nimitta. Your old friend. Hopefully it hasn't been 40 years since you last saw each other. But with a friend, when you see them, you relax in their presence. You don't control them. You don't tell them what to talk about or what to drink or what to eat. You relax. You're at ease with them. And that perception of ease and the perception that this is the nimitta, very refined. And you can only do that now, if you do develop this faculty of perception. One perception has vanished and something more refined and subtle has come up. And of course, this is the nature of perception. When something is stable and does not move, it disappears. It's a great sort of understanding of how meditation works. You know, through this prism of the refining of perception, the coarse vanishes when it's still, leaving the thing which is more refined. And of course, what vanishes, you know, when the nimitta vanishes, what's left is this incredible world called jhanas. And everybody seems to be into jhanas these days. And they talk about it and they describe it and they say it's this way and that way. Haven't got a clue what they're talking about, because they haven't had the perception of the jhanas yet. Very, very refined. Nimittas are refined enough. Now you really get into the ephemeral world of the mind, these jhana places. Incredible bliss. But what actually is that bliss? You know, you've often heard me say in the talks that bliss is better than sex. It is better than sex, but of a totally different quality. A peaceful bliss, a subtle bliss, It is far more enriching bliss than what else you can say about it, trying to sort of describe these things. But when you first get into these states, of course you don't recognize it. It's weird. Which is why a lot of times we have what I used to give it the name ping pong jhanas. Ping pong jhanas in and out again afterwards. One of the reasons is not just excitement, one of the reasons is when you get in there you don't know what to watch. What am I supposed to do again? Which means that you disturb the whole thing. And unfortunately it seems to be that that's what most people have to do. But me giving these talks means I hope you do it less than I had to do. In other words, you go quicker in. You don't waste so much time. As you realize what's happening next, when the nimitta disappears, you let it disappear. And what's left? At first, this is weird. It's a perception which you're not used to. Leave it. After a while, you recognize it. After a while, you become familiar with it. After a while, you become at ease with it. Even the object of mind, called the first jhana. You know, it's much, much better not to worry about the jhana factors and try and concoct them. That is just, to me, that's the most weird and unhelpful way to get into these states. You've got to leave them alone. Let go, become very still, because when again you're still, things vanish, the nimitta vanishes, now you're into something far more subtle. After a while you get to know what they are. You'll come out afterwards, and that's when you look upon jhana factors or ekagata or anything else, that's when you know what those things are. You know, that's the thing, you've got to have the experience first of all. And once you come out of the experience, that's what they meant by that word, vitakka vichara. Now I understand what piti sukha, born of the five senses disappearing, is. You've got to gather the evidence first and then apply the names, not the other way around. Not apply the names and try and concoct the evidence. That doesn't work. So that we just get these incredibly fine perceptions. Now this is not just for the sake of getting into these jhanas. I'm not going to go further because you need more experience to understand what we're talking about. But these are the perceptions, and I'll maybe just go a little bit further. The perception of the first jhana vanishes, another perception of the second jhana appears. Totally different. Which is actually the weird when that first happens. Because you know, it's very easy to get into the trap that this first jhana is the ultimate. Because it appears pretty sort of supreme and blissful and sort of enlightening. But it's weird when that perception goes. And another one, far more refined. Because the point is, you feel that you've got to the end. There can't be anything beyond this. And then you do find something beyond it. That's actually one of the great inferences you get when you go through more than one jhana. When you get to a second jhana, then it's incredible, powerful, still peaceful, this must be the end. But then you think back, and this is outside of jhana, obviously, well, that's what I thought about the first jhana, maybe there is more about this. Maybe there is things which are deeper. And of course, you know, you see the suttas, they say there are. So you allow the mind not to stop, but just to go deeper. And even the most refined perception of a second jhana, you can let that one go. You're at ease with it, stay still. Because of its stillness, it vanishes. And again, a third jhana. The course of things vanishing and the more subtle perceptions arising. And now you're really getting into some really powerful stuff. And there are third jhana, fourth jhana. Get into the immaterial states. Now you're really playing around with perception and finding out just how subtle it can be. The perception of nothingness. Or infinite consciousness, you know, of nothingness. The perception of neither perception or non-perception. That's really cool, to be able to sort of understand what that means. The most refined perception, to recognize that, be familiar and have ease with it. It just shows you what's actually possible. What's really happening there is you're just seeing just the nature of this mind. There's a perception and the ability to have more and more subtle perceptions until it becomes so subtle the perception vanishes and stops. It's the end of perception. It gets more and more refined as you go through. And of course, as you come out afterwards, then you understand what this perception truly is. Rather, where it comes from, this mind, this consciousness. As it said, as we chanted, Yan Kinchi Samudaya Dhammang Sabantang Nirodha Dhammanti. What is the nature to arise, has an origin, as a samudaya. All that has a nature to cease. Even perception has a nature to stop. And that's weird. Because that means your mind is stopping, things are ending. It's a taste of enlightenment. It gives you the meaning of what's happening. But anyway, that may be a long way further along the track. But what one is really doing here is understanding. One is training one's perception to become more and more and more subtle. It's easy to perceive the coursings in life. And it's easy to gain insights into the coursings of life. Yeah, we're born and we die. Yeah, we can't take anything with us. Yeah, this body sucks. We all know that. Yeah, you know, it's sex, you have a bit of fun and it's problems afterwards. You get pregnant, have relationships and all that sort of stuff. You know, the course insights are just, yeah, they're useful. And you become a great teacher and teach other people with the course of insights. But the stuff which is the really interesting stuff, the stuff which sets the Buddha apart, is the refined perceptions. To get to understand what silence is, what peace is. Even like what freedom is, sometimes I just linger on that. You know, when you're getting into some meditation, perceive what freedom is. What does it mean? And of course, there's so many different levels of freedom. And it was only when you really learnt to refine your perception of the meaning of freedom that I realized that the two types of freedom, the freedom of desire and the freedom from desire. And just that perception, that difference, just opening your eyes to a subtlety in the different types of freedom. It's not just freedom, there's hundreds of different nuances to that word. So many different types of freedom, but the ones which were very interesting, the ones which were free from desire and the ones which were the freedom of desire. And of course that gave you a great insight into the Four Noble Truths. Freedom of desire is getting your own way whenever you want it. Being able to get your own breakfast. So those of you on retreat, why do you actually get your own breakfast? Why didn't you get someone else to put whatever they think they want into your bowl? Why? Oh, because I might get tummy ache. No, it's not that, because you won't get what you like. So, isn't it a problem? I remember just in Thailand, you had all these big, you know, in Wat Bapong, before Wat Nanachat was up and running. There may be about 60 or 70 monks in that monastery. And what we used to do, there was two lines on either side, so 30 monks on each side. And the young monks had to get up and get a pot of curry, whatever it was. And you put a spoon in sort of the monks' bowls, you know, enough so it would get to the end of the line. And so you just gave the right amount. And the monks only had a choice, you know, sort of take it or leave it. They could say no. And the trouble was that, you know, there was some food which I really didn't like, that, you know, the hot chili stuff. And so I used to try and get that pot, so to make sure that no one else put it in my bowl. And there used to be so much stress and suffering, and sometimes, you know, you get somebody coming down and they got it before you, and you try and say, please, not in my bowl, but you didn't catch them in time. And that was your one meal of the day, ruined. And I was just trying to control things. And after a while, I said, oh, what the heck, just let go. And you're much more peaceful when you didn't try and control things. When I gave up freedom of desire, then you got to freedom from desire, which was far more beautiful. So just check those perceptions. What is actually freedom? Do you really want to be free? Because sometimes people say, oh, what are you in a monastery for? You're not free, you can't watch movies, you can't do what you want. You can't sort of go where you want. You just got no freedom. It's like being in a prison. Even in Guantanamo Bay, you get 3 meals a day. But no, there's something else which we're doing here, and you're developing the perception of the freedom from desire. You're developing the perception of contentment. These are great perceptions to linger on, and use contentment as your meditation object. That's what I'm going to focus on, contentment. Contentment, contentment, contentment. It's very powerful, because it leads to incredibly deep states of meditation. And you learn what contentment is. You can recognize it. It's not a word which you look up in a dictionary. It's something which you're so familiar to it with, you're at ease with, it's one of your best friends. When I recognize what contentment is, every time you sort of want to take a bit of a break and rest, even if you're busy, if you're traveling, if you're talking, I recognize contentment. And when I perceive contentment, I understand what it is, it's there in my mind at any time. So you can perceive the freedom from desires. You know exactly what it is. It's a good friend. Therefore, it's not just a theory anymore. It's not an inspiring idea. It's a reality. Something which you can look upon as your meditation object and allow it to just be there and enjoy the beautiful results of just perceiving the freedom from desire as your meditation object. Freedom from want as your meditation object. As you recognize these things, they become a tremendous skill in your meditation. It takes you into deep meditation, but also it teaches you the insights which is called the Dhamma. You understand, from this practice of perception, what perception is. You can see that through the development of these coarse to fine, to very refined, to incredibly subtle, to mega incredibly subtle perceptions, you can see what this perception actually is in its different forms. You see how it works, how the mind works. And especially you see this great truth that when things become still, they vanish. They do disappear, seeing what's really underneath them and what's more subtle. And it's there you find the great insights which make you an enlightened being. So to develop your meditation, develop your perceptions. Remember those three stages once more. You recognize, become familiar, and you're at ease. Then you know that you've completed the course. And of course, once you're at ease, it vanishes, you go to the next stage. There should never be a time in your meditation, if you understand this talk, when you don't know what to watch in meditation. You watch what's right here. You don't watch what you want to have next. You watch what's right here. Long enough for your perception to become familiar with it and at ease with it. And then you develop. That's the way of meditation. Also the way of insight. That's the talk this evening. Very good.